The world is supported by Wise, the smart new way to move money internationally. Imagine a world where you could speak any language, travel to any place, and spend in any currency with ease. At Wise, they're building the money part. Wise is the world's most international account. It lets you hold and convert dozens of currencies all in one place. And you always get the real exchange rate with no markups like the banks sometimes give you. So whether you're sending money to Australia, hopping on a plane to Poland, or getting paid from France, Wise is all you need. Designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
For years, the Afghan government worked to disarm warlords. Now there's a rush to revive them.
They have people with guns. How professional they are or how effective they are against the Taliban, these are the questions.
Meanwhile, another provincial capital falls to the Taliban, Puli Kumri, a strategic crossroads in northern Afghanistan.
There is really only one road through from north to south, and that runs through Puli Kumri.
Also today, predominantly Muslim Iraq has long been home to Christians.
Since the 3rd or 4th century after Christ.
After 18 centuries, some Iraqi Christians are barely hanging on to their ancient homelands. I'm Marco Werman, and heading to France soon, you've got a petit problème. That's coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being here. The news is moving at a frightening pace in Afghanistan. Not only are U.S. military forces mostly withdrawn from the country at this point, Taliban aggression on cities and provinces continues to yield more military victories for the militants. Afghan government troops have been overstretched and at times overwhelmed. So Kabul is searching for help anywhere it can find it, even if it means working with former warlords. The world's Shirin Jafari went to meet one of them recently in the western Afghan city of Herat.
To meet the former governor and warlord Ismail Khan at his villa, you need to pass by several concrete barriers. Two metal gates guarded by men with guns. Then you'll be escorted into the large garden and greeted by flamingos, peacocks, parrots, and other animals, most of which, the guard tells me, were gifted to Ismail Khan by his supporters. Khan is a well-known figure in Afghanistan. He's 72 years old, soft-spoken, with a long white beard. The locals here call him the Lion of Herat. Khan fought the Soviets in the 1980s. He took up arms against the Taliban in the 90s and spent time in Taliban captivity. After the US-led invasion, Khan served in the Afghan government. Today, he's back in the spotlight. I had no intention of getting involved in the fighting, he says. I expected a peace agreement. But every day, I watch as the Taliban get closer and closer to major cities. So it's my duty to stand up against them. Khan says the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan has been chaotic and mismanaged.
America should be back.
The U.S. had to leave, he says. There is no question about that. But they should have planned their exit in a better way. Khan complains that no one from the U.S. consulted him before the withdrawal. We were left in the dark, he says. Khan has been calling on his supporters to join the fight. And they're showing up from all over the country. Piroz Ahmad is from Faryab, a province in the north. He says 40 men from there have joined Khan's militia. They speak with me in Ismail Khan's garden, sitting on Persian rugs with their guns propped up against the wall behind them. Piroz Ahmad says he has never fought in a war, but he's ready to kill if he needs to. People don't want the Taliban, he says. They don't want their girls to be banned from going to school. What the Taliban is doing is unjust, Piroz Ahmad says. The Americans are gone. Who is the Taliban fighting now? The men in Khan's militia receive a stipend and weapons from the Afghan government. The return of armed militias in Afghanistan is a complete reversal of what the U.S. and its Afghan partners have tried to achieve in the past two decades. That's according to Dawood Azami, a journalist and academic.
So the strategy since the new government was established after the fall of the Taliban had been to weaken these powerful commanders, different islands of power in Afghanistan.
The goal was to bring stability by strengthening the central government and its military. Azami says they bought back weapons from the warlords and offered their fighters jobs in the army. Now all of that is being undone. Ismail Khan is just one of several former warlords who are now mobilizing against the Taliban. Shortly after I meet with Khan and some of his men, the Taliban intensified its attacks on the city. Videos circulated online showing Khan rushing to the front lines. The fighting went on for 3 days. Afghan government forces succeeded in pushing the insurgents back with the help of Khan's men. But Dawood Azami, the academic, says Afghanistan's warlords and their militias have a complicated history.
I mean, their name is associated with many wars. So that's why for some they are heroes and for others they are villains, because in those wars, people's houses were damaged, their properties were damaged, their relatives were killed or injured. So that's why their reputation is mixed.
These militias are mostly inexperienced and untrained, Azami says. Now they're being put to the test. For the world, Shirin Jafari, Herat, Afghanistan.
Three more regional capitals fell to the Taliban yesterday. That makes 9 in less than a week. One of the latest to fall is the city of Puli Kumri in Baghlan province, a vital piece of real estate that Chris Wolf knows well. Chris is a former staffer on our show, and when he was a BBC reporter back in 1991, he came under fire in Puli Kumri. Chris, why is the city of Puli Kumri so important?
In a word, geography, Marco. It sits at the northern end of the entrance to the Salang Valley. So you've got to remember that Afghanistan is divided pretty much between north and south by the enormous Hindu Kush mountains, brutal, rugged mountains. And there is really only one road through from north to south that runs through Puli Kumri. With that city occupied by the Taliban, it has very critical implications. The first being the government's going to find it extremely hard to provide meaningful military aid, supplies and reinforcements to the beleaguered outposts in the north. And conversely, those soldiers and government officials who are still in the north are going to find it extremely difficult to try and retreat to the capital area.
Are you surprised that Puli Kumri fell to the Taliban?
Yes. The Baghlan province, like much of the north, has a historically deep, abiding hatred for the Taliban. The populations there have both been targeted by the Taliban in the past. There's a Shia sect called the Ismailis, many of whom are Hazara people who are a more East Asian-looking ethnic minority, and they have been brutally persecuted by the Taliban in the past. They've fought them very hard. The other big population group in Baghlan is Tajik speakers, who, again, have a great antipathy to the Taliban. And so it's kind of dovetails with what Shirin was just telling us about how the government is only now trying to galvanize, mobilize, and secure the support of local populations and local strongmen. Ghani, you've got to remember, he's a professor, the president of Afghanistan. Mm. He's been relying on the regular forces that the U.S. military have created. They're very good, but they're kind of locked into position defense, and they aren't really helping out in the communities like the local militias really could do. So it's shocking to see that those strong feelings in Baghlan province have not been mobilized by the Kabul government to try and resist the Taliban, whose rule, I'm sure, is not welcome there now.
Tell us more about the city of Puli Kumri. What do you remember?
As I said, it's at the entrance to a valley. So it's strung along a riverbed on either side for several miles. So it's very long and very narrow. It's a more modern city. The ancient capital of Baghlan province is the city of Baghlan. And so Puli Kumri has a much more modern feel to it, a lot of concrete square structures, so not a lot of charm. And it's surrounded on both sides by the foothills of the Hindu Kush Mountains. So you could see how it could be vulnerable to fire if your enemy was able to get its heavy weapons up onto those foothills.
Chris, what is the big picture here? Like, if Puli Kumri can fall, then complete the sentence.
Kabul can fall. I have been stubbornly optimistic in my own analysis, along with a lot of other keen observers up to this moment. But if Puli and all these other places in the north can fall so easily, where the people are so antipathetic to the Taliban, it's hard to see what could happen next. Well, it's too easy to see what can happen next. Most Afghans hate the Taliban. There's no question about that. But it appears that they're not willing to die for the Ghani government.
Chris Wolf telling us about the city of Puli Kumri in Afghanistan, which has just fallen to the Taliban. Chris is the author of the soon-to-be-published book, Bumbling Through the Hindu Kush, a memoir of fear and kindness in Afghanistan. Chris, good to speak with you. Thank you.
Pleasure as always, Marco.
If you're thinking about squeezing in some late summer travel this year, the CDC might have just thrown a wrench into your plans. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports on news that hits close to home and abroad.
My friend Christine called at the end of June to tell me she's getting married to her pandemic boyfriend. The wedding is at the end of August in the south of friggin' France. I moved heaven and earth to make sure I could go. And then yesterday, I got a text from my dad with a link to the CDC website. The CDC just updated its list of countries that Americans should not travel to. And at the top of that list, France. On Monday, the CDC moved France to level 4, very high level of COVID-19. That's the highest travel alert. There are some surprising countries on that list. Israel, for example, which is a world leader in vaccinations, but is seeing a surge in Delta cases right now. Iceland is there, which is another popular destination for Americans. Iceland has a higher vaccination rate than the U.S., and it's only reported one death from COVID this year. One in May. It's not that you can't go to these countries. It's just that the CDC is telling you not to go, even if you're vaccinated. Dr. Lina Wen is an emergency room physician and a professor of public health at George Washington University. She says the list does seem perplexing.
There are many American states that have higher levels of COVID-19 infection than some of the countries that are currently in the level 4 category.
Wen says if you have a trip planned to one of those countries, you should do your own risk-benefit analysis. Consider stuff like the number of COVID cases where you live versus where you're going, and whether the hospital system there is overburdened, which would make it harder to get emergency care of any kind. Also, she says, think about the COVID regulations in place.
For example, if you have to show proof of vaccination, if you have to have a negative test prior to going, if there's even a required quarantine period, which could make travel unpleasant.
Like in France, you need a special health pass issued by the government in order to get into cafes, museums, concerts, etc. If you're an American vaccinated in the U.S., you can get one of those passes, but there's this whole online application. The thought of dealing with French bureaucracy right now gives me a panic attack. So I called off my trip this morning. With little kids at home who aren't vaccinated, it just didn't make sense. I hope that if you have a trip planned to one of the level 4 countries, your risk calculation looks better than mine. And if you go to the south of France, please send me a postcard. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. More than 95% of Iraqis identify as Muslim, but for centuries, the region we call Iraq today has been home to many religions, Christians, Jews, Yazidis, and Kakays, to name just a few. Perfect coexistence may not have been attained, but since the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003, trust within minority religious communities has eroded deeply. In northeast Iraq, the famous plains of Nineveh is a patchwork of religions in the country. Reporter Rebecca Collard traveled to one Christian town there and has our story.
In the town of Bartila, young Iraqi Christians prepare for their first communion. The teacher is speaking Aramaic, the same Semitic language spoken by Jesus. Bartila is one of the world's oldest Christian communities. And Father Benem Benoka, a priest at one of the town's six churches, says until a few decades ago, it was a place where only Christians lived.
Became Christian since the 3rd or 4th century after Christ, and continued like that till 1980.
The former dictator Saddam Hussein was in power back then and started nationalizing farmland around Bartila. The property mostly went to Sunni Arab military officers and their families. The idea, says Father Benoka, was to change the demographics here.
So for sure, before 1980 was everything okay. When everybody were living in Iraq as a Iraqi citizen under the same law.
But that changed, says Father Benoka, and it played out across Iraq. In places where Saddam Hussein viewed other religious or ethnic groups with suspicion, he feared those people were less than loyal to his rule and began settling members of his own Sunni Arab sect in those areas. When ISIS swept through this part of Iraq in 2014, everyone fled Bartila. 7 years later, fewer than half the 4,000 Christian families who once lived here have returned. Father Benoka says the Christian character of Bartila is now being eroded even further by another one of Iraq's long persecuted religious minorities, Shabaks.
We're still suffering from Shabaks' invasion.
The Shabaks of Iraq number about 300,000, and their origin is unclear. They speak a mix of Arabic, Persian, Kurdish, and Turkmen. Father Benoka sees them as foreigners, descendants of the army of a Persian ruler who conquered this area in the 18th century. Others say the Shabak are ethnically Kurds or even Arabs who mostly practice Shia Islam. Many of the Shabak consider themselves a distinct group, neither Kurd nor Arab, with unique religious tradition. Either way, Saddam also saw them as a threat. And in the 1980s, the Shabak faced a campaign of forced displacement and assimilation. Thousands were locked away in detention camps. As non-Sunni Muslims, they were also persecuted by ISIS. Since ISIS was defeated here, Shabak families have returned in much larger numbers than Christians, who see themselves as the indigenous people of this region. Father Benoka says it's all part of a nationalist project. The Shabak, he says,
are working to create Shabakistan, which they called it. They think to have the center here in Bartila, the capital of the Shabakistan.
Some Christians here say the Shabak won't buy from Christian businesses, instead opening their own nearby and pushing Christians out of the market. Others point to new residential developments that encourage more Shabak to move to Bartila. There are now just a few thousand Christians in a town of around 15,000 people, and hundreds of Christian homes remain empty. They are now the clear minority. On the other side of town is one of these new developments with about 200 modern homes and neatly paved roads.
Hello.
Mohammed Yahya shows us around his new home. Yahya is Shabak and moved here just 5 days ago with his wife and three children. He's originally from a village about 15 miles away and says in 2012 he moved to Mosul. He says his brother was killed because he was Shabak, so they fled again when ISIS came in 2014.
Before we seen the wars before this situation in 2014 and even before 2014 there was a all the minorities were targeted in airplanes, but not anymore after 2017. We are very happy with the situation now.
But even after his village was liberated from ISIS, Yahya didn't want to go back.
But there was lack of services and it was very bad and very crowded. And I took this house here because it's very clean and it's all new houses.
He's renting the place here in Bartila and teaching at a local school. Yahya paints a very different picture than Father Benoka, one of a kind of coexistence among Iraqi citizens in Bartila. He says he wants to live side by side with Iraqis from other religious and ethnic groups. The plains of Nineveh, this area surrounding Mosul that includes Bartila, are some of the most diverse parts of Iraq. Yahya calls it a little Iraq.
And I already found a Christian, a Turkmani, and an Arab here. So we can say we have also a little Iraq here, and I like this kind of diversity.
While Yahya sees Bartila as a place for all Iraqis, many Christians feel threatened by what they see as the transformation of their once distinctly Christian community. Shabaks formed their own militia unit and played a key role in ousting ISIS from Bartila. Now at the entrance to Bartila hangs posters of Shia militia leaders and fighters celebrated for helping to liberate the area from ISIS. And Shia militiamen still control many of the checkpoints in the area.
The matter of ISIS finished, but they're still controlling the Christian cities.
Back at the church, a group of young Christians are fixing a small library that had been burned during their exile. All the books were destroyed. They're painting walls and cutting wood for bookshelves in preparation for new ones. There were 1.5 million Christians in Iraq when the U.S. invaded in 2003. Now, there are just a few hundred thousand left. Father Benoka says if Christians are pushed out of historically Christian towns like Bartila, they will leave Iraq.
The risk is not for the Christian. The risk is for all of Iraq. Iraq will lose principal and fundamental part of Iraqi society. This will for sure will influence badly on the future of Iraq society.
And at least there, Father Benoka and Mohammed Yahya seem to agree. Iraq's religious diversity, this little Iraq, is an important part of the country's national fabric. For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard, Bartila.
Rebecca's story is part of our reporting project, Sacred Nation, where we explore the intersection of religion and nationalism across the globe. Find more at theworld.org/sacrednation. You're listening to The World. Thousands of dissidents are fleeing Hong Kong for the UK. Abruptly starting a new life in London is bringing challenges.
If you don't have a valid address proof, the bank won't let you to open the account.
Catch 22, no bank account makes it hard to get that address, and around it goes. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In a summer of global out-of-control wildfires, add Algeria to the list. Today in northern Algeria, rescue crews race to help people in the heavily forested region of Kabylie, east of the capital Algiers. At least 65 people have been killed in fires that began on Monday, including some 28 Algerian soldiers sent to battle the flames. Government officials have blamed arson for some of the 80 fires in Algeria, but have not yet offered proof. No doubt the flames were fanned by strong winds and tinder dry conditions, and daytime temperatures topping 100 degrees. Elsewhere in the Mediterranean, Greece has seen around 600 fires in the past week. The biggest are on Evia, a heavily forested mountainous island, Greece's second largest. The fires on Evia have been driven by a record-breaking heat wave, with temperatures reaching up to 115 degrees Fahrenheit. On the north side of the island, the blazes destroyed homes and displaced hundreds of people. Scientists have long warned that increasing wildfires are a consequence of climate change. The World's Lydia Manalidou visited the island of Evia and followed one group of locals on the front lines.
deep in the forest in northern Evia, about 20 people, some young, some not so young, sit on the ground and take a rest under the shade of pine trees. They've been here day and night, keeping watch for nearly a week. Their eyes are bloodshot, and they look exhausted. Panagiotis Theodorou was born and raised in these parts, and he says he's never seen anything like this. The fires have forced thousands of people to evacuate the island, but Theodorou and his childhood friend, Yannis Stamoulos, aren't going anywhere. Stamoulos lives in Athens now, but he's using his vacation time to help with the fires. Stamoulos points ahead and tells me that right now they're monitoring a fire in the hills just in front of us, about half a mile away. There's a cloud of smoke over the trees there. Planes and helicopters occasionally fly over and drop water, but that's not enough. You need to fight these fires from the ground. And that's all too much for the village's sole and small fire truck. Locals tell me that the help from outside hasn't been reliable or consistent. So they're taking matters into their own hands. Suddenly there's a commotion when the men notice more smoke up ahead. One man grabs his chainsaw. Others are putting on these yellow water tank backpacks that have spritzers attached to them. Then they hop onto their tractors, their motorbikes and cars, and rush up the hill towards the fire. I'm with a few other journalists, and we catch a ride on the metal digger on the front of the bulldozer. Up on the hill, the smoke is thick, and much of the forest already turned to ash. The men immediately get to work to stop the fire from spreading.
One of the tractors has a water pumping mechanism attached to it, and they have a hose, and they're spraying down the flames here.
They use the bulldozer to dig out some wild shrubs and chainsaws to cut down a few trees. And they say this helps prevent the fire from jumping from one thing to another. Many of the people on the island of Evia depend on these forests to make a living. Some of the guys here harvest resin from the pine trees, says Ilias Nikolarakos.
If you notice on the trees, there are bags.
Look.
Bags full of sticky, gooey, yellowy resin are attached to some of the pine trees. They harvest it and then sell it to producers who use it in some Greek wine and other products. There are men here who've already lost most or all of their pine trees. There's more commotion when we're told that a new fire on the hill has flared up and is moving towards us.
So we should run.
I'm running next to 31-year-old Stavros, who didn't give me his last name.
He's
saying we've been living this for 6 days, so...
When we get down to relative safety, the men call in other locals to help. But we find out that another fire has broken out nearby, and this one is heading straight for a village. I hear one of the locals, who goes by Babi, saying... I feel like we're so alone. I don't know what to do. I'm going to start crying. The men huddle to discuss their next move, and Babis gets flustered. He argues that everyone needs to go to this second fire. He's convinced that the forest right in front of us, the one we were just in, is doomed, and trying to salvage it is a lost cause. Other locals start to arrive, including the village's Orthodox priest, who rolls in on a tractor. A plane comes in and drops water on the fire we were just in, and people are relieved. But then they see an additional helicopter going to a third location right nearby.
They're saying the helicopters are there, which means we're surrounded by fire and we should leave.
A fallen tree is blocking the way, but the men use their crane to remove it, and we're off. From the rearview mirror, I watch them once again grab their tools, jump on their vehicles, and head to their next battle. For The World, I'm Lydia Manoulidou, reporting from Evia, Greece.
Canadian entrepreneur Michael Spavor has already spent more than 2 years in solitary confinement in a Chinese jail cell. Today, Chinese authorities sentenced him to 11 more years in prison. Spavor was arrested on charges of spying in 2018. Many call his arrest diplomacy by hostage-taking. He was detained just days after Canadian police arrested Chinese telecom executive Meng Wanzhou in Vancouver. Meng is fighting extradition to the U.S., where she faces fraud charges related to her company's dealings with Iran. Michael Byers has been watching all of this closely. He teaches law at the University of British Columbia. Remind us first, if you would, who Michael Spavor is and what he's been accused of.
Michael Spavor is a Canadian who has lived in northern China for quite a number of years. His business was facilitating tourism into North Korea. Not a very high-profile person, but was arrested by the Chinese government for alleged spying violations.
So let's remember, too, that Spavor was arrested at the same time as another Canadian, Michael Kovrig, a former Canadian diplomat, whom Chinese authorities say was working with Spavor. So the idea that this is a diplomacy by hostage-taking, explain that.
The view has been taken by the Canadian government that these arrests were in retaliation for the detention of Meng Wanzhou. The Chinese government has never admitted to that linkage, and yet it's clear that we have the ingredients here for some kind of exchange.
Why is it clear to you?
The Chinese court, in its verdict, explicitly said that Michael Spavor should be deported. It did not specify when, but the Chinese government now has that card in its pocket and presumably will have a second if the same verdict is released with regards to Michael Kovrig. The extradition case in Canada is proceeding towards quite a decisive phase where we expect the extradition judge to issue her decision in the next month or so. It's possible she will order Ms. Meng's release. Or alternatively, it's possible that the Canadian Minister of Justice will order her release after the verdict and do so in exercise of his discretion under the Extradition Act. So I think there's a possibility that everything will be resolved, but it will require one crucial ingredient, and that is the willingness of the Joe Biden administration in the United States to tolerate Ms. Meng being sent home to China instead of being transferred to face justice in the United States. And if she were to win this phase of the extradition, the normal thing to happen would be for the Canadian government to appeal that decision and push this to the next level of courts.
Meantime, Meng Wanzhou, who is from a very powerful Chinese family, she's living in relative luxury compared to the two Michaels, as I gather.
Yes, she's living in a mansion in Vancouver. But to give your listeners a sense of the amount of wealth that she holds, at a previous stage in the extradition process, when it looked like she might be set free, a chartered Boeing 777 was waiting for her at Vancouver Airport. This is not a woman who flies on small private jets. She flies on the largest jets imaginable.
Wow. If I'm a Western businessman, I'm seeing today's sentence against Michael Spavor, and I'm really thinking twice about doing anything in China. And if I'm already invested there, this would really worry me. Could this hostage diplomacy backfire and blow up in China's face?
Obviously, it is damaging to China's reputation and to the sense of safety that foreign business people have when they travel to China. And I would suggest that the Chinese regime cares first and foremost about economics, and foreign trade and investment are central to that. I think everyone here wants to find a resolution. It's just made difficult by the fact that we have a rule of law system in Canada, and we have a binding extradition treaty with the United States. So finding a way out of that box that enables all sides to hold to their principles and interests, that is the challenge for the Canadian government right now.
What's your best guess? Is there a safe way out of this box?
Well, there is likely to be a Canadian federal election in about 2 months, and there's nothing more that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau would like to announce than the fact that the two Michaels are coming home.
We'll leave it there. Michael Byers teaches law at the University of British Columbia. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
For 99 years, China leased the small island of Hong Kong to the British Empire. That agreement ended in 1997, but Communist China made an agreement with the UK that Hong Kong would remain a capitalist haven for another half century. With democratic norms now quickly eroding in Hong Kong, the former colonial power is responding. The UK is offering a new visa and path to citizenship to millions of Hong Kongers. Nearly 35,000 people jumped at the offer in the first quarter of the year. Reporter Andrew Connolly in London spoke with some of those new arrivals.
It's a stormy day in late July down by London's Docklands area, with the gleaming skyscrapers of the financial district on one side and the watery expanse of the River Thames on the other. There's a distant resemblance to Hong Kong. That's the hometown of Simon Cheung, a 30-year-old former employee of the British consulate who was forced to escape after being detained during a business trip to mainland China in August 2019.
I still remember that the doctors back in detention centre, he sighed when the first day he understand I've been experienced torture. And I've been told by national security police to say I just sleep on the floor or something. So almost the first
week... Obviously the doctor knew what was going
on. Yeah, what was going on. And the first week I almost can't walk.
Cheung was accused of inciting anti-government protests in Hong Kong, charges he denies. Before being released, he was told to keep quiet or else.
They said if I don't comply, then they would send the police to take me back.
Cheung fled first to Taiwan and was then granted political asylum by UK authorities. But an increasing number of Hong Kongers are also starting new lives in the UK through what Prime Minister Boris Johnson has called one of the biggest changes to the visa system in British history. Lin Kuang left a good life and a job teaching sports management at a college in Hong Kong as soon as she heard about the BNO visa programme. She feels welcome in London, like one of the locals, she says, but still adjusting to the bureaucracy of setting up a new life, like finding a place to live.
It's a cycle. If you don't have a valid address proof, the bank won't let you to open the account. At the same time, if you don't have a valid bank account, maybe it's difficult for you to rent a house.
Kuang has a 12-year-old son, and one of her major motivations to move to London is so that he can enjoy the freedom of speech that is fast evaporating back home.
People can have different standpoint, but the point is we have freedom to choose. That's important. And that's very important for my kid, my next generations as well.
So Monday, Wednesday and Friday we have luncheon club.
Since the 1980s, the Hackney Chinese Centre in East London has welcomed successive waves of refugees fleeing political upheaval in East Asia. On a Friday morning, old men sing karaoke, women serve up vast plates of steamed pork, and crowds gather around mahjong games and massage classes. Centre manager Jabez Lam says that as soon as the BNO visa route was announced, Hong Kongers were arriving unannounced at UK airports, often without any idea of where to go for help.
I would have preferred that the government realise they need to have support in place before they plan the rule for the BNO visa.
Lam says one of the most pressing needs, along with housing and employment, is mental health support for the new arrivals. Young people in particular, he says, are suffering both from the trauma of events they witness back home and the hardship of moving to the other side of the world.
My parents have received reports from teachers about the children's behaviour, sign of PTSD. Young people in particular frequently talk about the hardship. And so I just talked to somebody yesterday saying that they feel they're urged to suicide.
In July, the British government announced a fund totaling around $60 million to help Hong Kongers integrate. But despite the obstacles for Hong Kongers, most exiles from other places have a much harsher experience in the UK. The BNO visa policy stands in stark contrast to the government's hostile approach towards other people fleeing persecution from Syria to Eritrea to Afghanistan and beyond. Emily Venturi from the London think tank Chatham House thinks that the BNO visa policy, while generous, focuses too heavily on one specific situation.
That goes back to the importance of the UK really having a solid reckoning when it comes to its colonial and military legacies, how it chooses to present morally and historically justified policies. And really, I think it points to the need for the UK to strengthen its consistency on its immigration and its foreign policies.
Back on the Docklands, Simon Cheung says that his newfound freedom has come at a price. He says he's made the heartbreaking decision to cut ties with family in Hong Kong.
I cut ties with them, and for their safety, I even never ever contact them.
And it's becoming harder for others to leave the city, thanks to a new immigration bill passed by Hong Kong's legislature earlier this month.
To me personally, I do believe that I could be back to my hometown, but only one condition, that the democracy and freedom could be back to my hometown. So that's the faith that I also wanted to convey to our Hong Kongers community in the UK as well.
For The World, I'm Andrew Connolly in London.
Belarus. To its east, the country borders Russia. To the west, it's Poland, Latvia, and Lithuania. And at those western borders, troubles are brewing. All three of those nations are in the European Union and are reporting massive increases in migrants trying to enter from Belarus. The migrants come mostly from Iraq and Afghanistan. By many reports, they are not being welcomed into Europe. Joining me to discuss this is Katia Glodz. She's an expert on Eastern Europe at the Center for European Policy Analysis and joins us from London. Katia, explain the sharp increase in migrants leaving Belarus. What's going on?
Basically, we have seen this increase in migrants for the past 2 months, and this is linked to the EU sanctions that the European Union imposed on the regime in Belarus following the mass protests and brutality with which these protests were dispersed and also the ongoing political repression. The regime of Alexander Lukashenko is really trying to tell the EU that either you stop these sanctions or we will try to create chaos and destabilize the situation in your own countries.
So is Lukashenko's regime essentially bringing migrants to the border and saying to them, go across, go to Latvia, go to Poland?
Yes, it looks very likely that this is what the regime is doing. We don't have any official data to prove that, but there have been several investigations undertaken by journalists. And it seems to be a whole network has been set up with the involvement of the Belarusian state-owned travel agencies who have been basically, we can say, even actively recruiting people, mainly from Iraq. So these travel agencies, they post ads, I guess, in the Iraqi media. And then the Belarusian embassy in Iraq gives visas to these people. And then these people come and they're hosted in Minsk hotels, and then even they escorted further to the Lithuanian border and now to Latvia and then to the Polish borders as well. Lukashenko is trying to create these issues of contention. He hopes that the EU will either stop the sanctions against him and the regime in general, or that the EU will stop hosting Belarusian political activists.
Katia, if Lukashenko's scheme here is to force the end of sanctions on him and his regime, do you think this way of doing it will work?
No, I don't think he will actually manage to persuade the EU by this tactic to withdraw the sanctions. And that's we have seen very firm response, particularly from Lithuania, saying that it will demand that the EU increase the sanctions and not revoke the sanctions. Obviously, the regime in Minsk had hoped that this kind of hybrid warfare tactic might help, but it's certainly not helping. So far, during the 2 months, we have seen nothing that that would indicate that the EU would be withdrawing the sanctions. And I think it will be only on the contrary, it will increase them.
We know most of these migrants are from Iraq, some are from Afghanistan. What does this whole experience with Belarus and being kind of taken to the border and told to cross and not being able to cross, what does this burden them with after what must be a really long and arduous journey to Belarus?
Well, the experience in Belarus hasn't been obviously nice. We hear many reports by independent journalists about how these people are treated, and they're not treated nicely, particularly by the Belarusian border patrol. We saw many of them being trapped into this neutral zone between the two countries, being under rain and under other unpleasant weather conditions and during these conditions. We have seen also some not very pleasant footage about some people being allegedly beaten or shot. But we also think that these might be some fake reports that, again, the regime in Belarus has been trying to use these migrants to present the situation as if Lithuania is not treating the migrants nice. But we do know that as many of them are going back, it obviously was not a good experience trying to use this route of coming into the youth rebellion.
So where do you think this goes from here?
Well, I think that the problem will be solved one way or another. It will probably take some time. It won't be solved overnight. I think with the EU transferring more resources, human and financial, to the neighboring countries, we'll see some eventual resolution to the crisis. Also, the EU together with the US is trying to put more pressure on the Iraqi government, and this is where the refugees mostly coming from. I think it will be solved mid-term. In the short term, I think we'll see the regime still trying to use this as a weapon with more refugees coming from Afghanistan. But I think the EU will mount a comprehensive response, financial and resource-wise, that would help to solve the problem eventually.
Katia Glod is an Eastern Europe expert at the Center for European Policy Analysis. She's based in London. Katia, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We were talking earlier on the show today about the wildfires outside the Algerian capital in the mountainous Kabylie region. Those fires are happening in a province known as Tizi Ouzou. Dozens of people died, including firefighters battling the flames. Meantime, Algerians in the capital, Algiers, have been rallying, sending large donations of bottled water and food to the people fleeing the wildfires. Tizi Ouzou is hard to reach, but it's significant as the ancestral home of Algeria's Berber people. This song is about it.
C'est une maison bleue. Attention à la police. On y vient à pied.
Tizi Ouzou is dear to musicians like the late Hamid Chériette, better known as Idir. The melody here was actually adapted from a French song in the 70s titled San Francisco by the pop singer Maxime Le Forestier. Idir reworked it as Tizi Ouzou. It's a collection of memories of his home in the Algerian mountains. Tizi Ouzou, Idir sings, it's hills that end the dreams of fools, the fools who want us to forget Tizi Ouzou. Today, not forgetting Tizi Ouzou, we dedicate the song to its people.
Peuplé de lumière, peuplé de fous, la maison berbère, la zèle de roue. Tizi Ouzou se lève, allons au bout de ce rêve. Tizi Ouzou.
The world comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. We're online 24/7 where you can read, see, and hear us. That's theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. You be safe, stay strong. We're back with you tomorrow.